Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. One of the key distinctions that St. Augustine of Hippo makes in Book 1 of On Free Choice of the Will is that between two fundamentally different kinds of law, one of which we very easily recognize because we're governed by it and we think of ourselves as operating within its confines, and that is what he would call temporal law. If we recognize some universal standards of morality that we think don't differ from place to place and time to time, then we also recognize what he calls the eternal law. And in Augustine's work, the eternal law has a priority over the temporal law. So this is a very important distinction. He tells us that the eternal law is what he calls the law of reason, and it cannot change. The temporal law, by contrast, can in fact change, and will vary from place to place and situation to situation. As a matter of fact, Augustine even brings up cases where the temporal law must change to adapt to new circumstances. And he tells us that will not any intelligent man regard that law as unchangeable and eternal, which is termed the law of reason? We must always obey it, he says. It is the law through which wicked people deserve an unhappy and good people a happy life, and through which the law we have said should be called temporal is rightly decreed and rightly changed. So there is a dependency of the temporal law upon the eternal law. The eternal law provides us with the criteria by which the temporal law should be made and the temporal law should be modified. So he tells us a little bit later that what is just and what is lawful in the temporal law actually derives from the eternal law. And he doesn't clarify it much more at that point, but he also says something else that's very interesting. A little bit earlier in the work, he says that a law which is not just does not appear to actually be a law at all. There's something of the very nature of law that requires that it be just. So there could be laws that are, as we say, on the books, or laws in the sense of orders from authority that are not actually law. They're not actually binding because they're not just. When they are in conflict with the eternal law, when they command us to do things that we know are wrong, or when they forbid us to do things that we know we ought to do, then we've got a serious problem there. And so Augustine is articulating that. What does he mean by the temporal law? Now, he's not giving you a whole treatise on law here, but he does have a couple very interesting examples of what its scope would be and how it might be changed. So it's well worth looking at those. Let's take a look at three particular discussions that he has. So in section 12 of this work, he tells us that the temporal law may in fact allow its subjects to engage in killing to prevent some other types of harms. So for example, this is actually in 11 and then into 12, he says, is the law just which authorizes a traveler to kill a robber in self-protection, or any man or woman to kill an assailant, if possible, before the violence has been carried out? What about laws that order a soldier to kill the enemy? If they refuse, they're punished by military authorities. Can we call these laws unjust or no laws at all? And his student, Evodius, says, I see pretty well that a law which gives its subjects permission to commit lesser crimes in order to prevent greater ones has a good defense against an accusation of this kind. It is a much lesser evil for the assassin than for the man who defends his own life to be killed. So we're saying that because somebody is engaging in aggression or planning aggression, it's unfortunate that somebody is killed, but better that that person is killed, the guilty, rather than the innocent. Or, in the case of the soldier, he says, when a soldier kills the enemy, he is enforcing the law and so has no difficulty in carrying out his duty, without passion. The law itself, which is issued to protect a subject, cannot be convicted of passion if its author issued it in obedience to God's will, that is, to fulfill eternal justice. He may have done so without any passion at all. Even if he issued it out of passion, it does not follow that the law need be carried out with passion, because a good law can be issued by a man who is not good. So this is an interesting discussion here. This always comes up, by the way, when people talk about, you know, the Ten Commandments and thou shalt not kill. One way in which that gets interpreted is thou shalt not commit murder. And so some forms of killing, for example, self-defense, might, although they're still not good in some respect, they're not as bad as going around and just killing somebody. And so the temporal law could make these sorts of distinctions, and that could be in accordance with eternal law. He also talks a little bit later on, another great example, this is in section 14, about governments, because governments are structured by law as well. He says, let's look at the law which is put forth in writing. Is it for the good of people living in this present life? The answer is yes. It's to help us out. It's to allow us to live together. So he says, do these peoples and states belong to the class of things which cannot perish or change? Are they altogether everlasting, or are they subject to time and change? And his student says, well, clearly they're subject to time and change. So here's where we get to the crux. If a people is well-disciplined and observant of social good, and such that every individual puts public before private interest, is not this people rightly granted by law authority to elect its own officials to govern its affairs, that is, affairs of the state? We're talking about representative government. Representative government, in order to be for the common good, actually requires that the people who are doing the voting think about the common good, not just their own interests, not just their own prejudices, not just their own desires, but that of the entire society, and sometimes be willing to sacrifice their own interests for the betterment of the totality. If that's not the case, then, according to Augustine, maybe that people doesn't actually deserve to rule itself. So he goes on and he says, if the people deteriorates and prefers private to public interest and sells its vote for bribes and is corrupted by ambitious politicians and puts into power criminals with no sense of honor, would not any honest man of sufficient influence who's left be justified in depriving this people of self-government and putting them under the authority of a few honest people or even of one? And Evodius says, yes, they would be. So, you know, that would be another configuration of temporal law. If a people can't govern itself and it's going to screw it up inevitably, maybe it's better to have a monarchy. Maybe it's better to have a triumvirate or something like that, right? Didn't actually work out that well for the Romans. I know Augustine knows that. Now, another thing that he discusses much later on, and this is towards the end of the work, he's talking about the goods that we call temporal, so wealth and bodily things and freedom and honors in the state and all these sorts of things. He says, how the law assigns to each person their share would be a long and difficult matter to explain, one plainly not necessary for our purpose. We need only notice that the power of this law to enforce itself does not extend further than to take away and confiscate as a punishment those things or a part of them. It brings pressure to bear through fear and to gain an end, turns and twists the souls of the unhappy people for whose government it is fitted. They can be, you know, kept in line. So, you know, the government allows sort of a distribution of goods, and it also can take away those things. And that's what the temporal law, one of its functions is, in fact. What about the eternal law? What does Augustine tell us about it? Besides the fact that there is an eternal law and that the temporal law should be looking to the eternal law in being structured and being changed. One thing right off the bat is he tells us, and this is in the same section, that the eternal law tells us human beings to prefer eternal goods to temporal ones. So we should be less concerned about making money or our financial status or bodily health or our social status or all of our relations or where we live, or go on and on and on and on, right? What school we get to go to. Not that those aren't good things or, you know, or important things. We should be less concerned about those than we are about eternal goods. So what are eternal goods? Possession of the virtues: justice, fortitude, temperance, wisdom. Right? Or prudence. We ought to value that. We ought to value having a good will. We ought to value the eternal law itself, above all of these other things, which means that it doesn't say that we can't have these other things, but when push comes to shove, we should give eternal law the preference. Eternal law is saying eternal law has to be first. Another thing he tells us is that everything should have its due order. And the way that this is being translated is actually expressing a kind of adverb, ordinatissima, ordered to the greatest degree, or most ordered, or most well ordered, right? And that should extend to ourselves. We should actually have our rational part running the show and not just our base desires or the lusts of the body or whatever it's going to be. And we should also be extending that into our fabrics of relationships within a society, including the temporal law. Finally, he tells us another thing about the structure of the eternal law, how it, in fact, you could say, structures the universe itself. Here we go. This is in section 30. He says, "The eternal law has settled this with unchangeable firmness. It is settled that merit lies in the will. Whether we deserve good things or not lies in our faculty of will. And reward and punishment lie in happiness and misery." So we can understand the eternal law not just as like a set of norms where, like, you know, oh, you should do this, don't do this, and then it sort of comes down and imposes itself on our norms. It's the very fabric of the universe itself, including how it is in our human nature, the will works. And we can either reject the eternal law and say, I'm going to, you know, try to see if I can do things differently. I'm sure that I can have all the temporal goods and also satisfy the eternal law because I'm an exception to the rule. We can do that if we want to. But we can't avoid suffering the consequences of doing that. So this is a very important distinction in Augustine's work, and hopefully now it's a little bit more clear what the difference between these two sorts of laws actually resides in.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.